If you've ever taken an online quiz to calculate your personal carbon footprint, go ahead and subscribe, leave us a glowing review. Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor podcast, where we talk about environmental and natural resources law and policy. This podcast is brought to you, as always, by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Group, and we're happy you're here with us. Taylor's here, my indefatigable co-host. We're also happy to welcome back Jeff Homestead, a partner in our DC office, who we turn to whenever we have big questions about some of the biggest developments in the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. And it's personally harder for me to think of a bigger development than this administration's intent to reconsider the endangerment finding for greenhouse gas emissions. So thank you, Jeff, for being here with us. Thank you for helping us to unpack what we're seeing from this administration.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I went back into our podcast history, Jeff, and as fate would have it, and I don't know if you recall this, but I certainly do, you were our first guest on the podcast. And right about 4 years ago at this time, we sat down for our first episode to talk about the Biden administration's plans for climate change, just a few months into that administration. And so despite all the changes of the past 4 years, the coming and going of a pandemic and all kinds of rules flying around in the Federal Register, here we are having a very similar conversation. So thanks for coming back.
But I don't think you mean to suggest that the actions of the Trump administration are necessarily going to be consistent with those from the Biden administration.
I don't think we will be seeing much in line with the previous 4 years. So Jeff, we're here to talk about the endangerment finding. And so I'd like to get some information from you on, take us back to 2008, 2009, when we first start seeing the administration's, you know, the executive branch try to grapple with what the Clean Air Act allows EPA to do, what EPA should do with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. What was the process that led us to the endangerment finding?
Let me go back maybe even a bit before 2008, 2009. During the Clinton administration, there was a rulemaking petition from a group of environmental groups that asked EPA to regulate CO2 emissions or more broadly greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. The Clinton administration didn't respond to that petition, and there's no obligation for EPA to respond to such a petition. But they did go through a process of considering how they might regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And the general counsel of EPA at the time issued a memo saying that EPA did in fact or could regulate CO2 emissions as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act if they exercised their discretion to do so. As you know, I came in during the George W. Bush administration, and we certainly had that memo in front of us. And my view then and my view now is that Congress never intended for EPA to regulate CO2 emissions under the Clean Air Act. It just doesn't make any sense under many of the programs by which EPA regulates air pollutants. And so we actually decided to respond to that rulemaking petition. And I was involved in drafting that response. And we cited to the Brown and Williamson case, which the Supreme Court also cited when it formally adopted the major questions doctrine. And our view and what we expressed in our response was the regulation of CO2 is an issue of enormous economic and political significance. And EPA can only regulate if Congress has clearly given it authority. There was no indication that Congress had actually sort of grappled with the implications of regulating CO2. And so we denied the rulemaking petition, not on the grounds that CO2 wasn't an issue, but that EPA didn't have authority from Congress to regulate CO2 emissions. That decision was upheld by the DC Circuit by a vote of 2-1. And then that action, that case became the Massachusetts versus EPA case that went to the Supreme Court. And in a 5-4 vote, they went the other way and said, no, that CO2 meets the regulatory definition of an air pollutant, and therefore EPA could regulate CO2 and other greenhouse gases if they found that emissions of greenhouse gases was reasonably anticipated to endanger public health and welfare. And so W. Bush administration actually sort of grappled with the question of whether they should make that finding. I had left by then, but I don't think anybody seriously believed that they could say that greenhouse gases did not endanger public health and welfare, but they, I think, did not want to be the administration that actually regulated CO2. So they took no action. And the Obama administration back in 2009, after going through notice and comment process, did make a formal finding. And this was under Section 201 of the Clean Air Act, dealing with mobile sources, with vehicles, that emissions of greenhouse gases, of these six different greenhouse gases, but primarily CO2, did cause or contribute to air pollution, which is reasonably anticipated to endanger public health and welfare. And it's that determination, that finding, that is now known as the endangerment finding. And having made that finding, EPA not only had authority, but had an obligation to regulate. And so ever since then, the question has been, how is EPA going to regulate CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act?
So to follow up on that, and maybe to dig into your own thinking back during the administration, when I think about greenhouse gases and CO2, you know, you have under the Clean Air Act a set of criteria pollutants that can, when they're emitted from a facility, people who live close to the facility might experience asthma or other health conditions. These pollutants, you know, are emitted out of a stack and kind of affect the area around them. Carbon dioxide's a little bit more of a global concern. And then you also have hazardous air pollutants that are hazardous for a variety of different reasons, have different kinds of effects on the human body or on the environment. And those are regulated under another portion of the Clean Air Act. And carbon dioxide doesn't really fit with those either. Was that sort of your thinking at the time?
That was certainly a big part of it, that, you know, the Clean Air Act had always been about regulating pollutants that have an adverse effect when you breathe them or when they're deposited on crops or something like that. So it was the impact of the constituents of the pollutants themselves on public health and welfare. And that's what the Clean Air Act was designed to do. The only thing that's different is back in 1990, when Congress really modernized the Clean Air Act, they did add a section for CFCs, for substances that deplete the high level ozone. And those are more analogous to greenhouse gases because in and of themselves, they're not toxic. They don't have immediate effects, but in the upper atmosphere, they thin the ozone layer and allow more harmful rays from the sun to get through. And so part of our thinking was Congress intended this to be about pollutants that harm people when they're exposed to them directly. The one exception for that, Congress, you know, went through the process to adopt a program that was really designed to deal with a different type of pollutant, but they had never done that for CO2. But it was also the fact that, especially with CO2, there's not control technologies. The amounts emitted are enormous by comparison to other pollutants. So as you well know, there's a lot of programs that regulate major sources of air pollution. Well, major sources of traditional air pollutants, conventional air pollutants, you have to be, you know, a pretty large industrial facility to be a major source. But if you're looking at the thresholds in the Clean Air Act of 250 tons per year, a large home and an office building, and I mean, there would be hundreds of thousands of major sources of CO2, which just didn't make any sense. So it just seemed like it was very different from any pollutant that Congress had intended EPA to regulate under the Clean Air Act.
And Jeff, looking back to what the Obama administration did, were they worried at that time about industrial sources or about facilities, or were they worried more about mobile sources? Because I think one of the focuses, right, was automobiles and the CO2 emissions that end up resulting from those sources, right? So how did they end up turning around the 2009 endangerment finding into sort of regulatory actions that then we now see some of the remnants of those today?
So that's a very good question. They did make the endangerment finding specifically under Section 201, which deals with mobile sources. And their first round of regulations was for light cars and trucks, was for automobiles. In another section of the Clean Air Act that deals with and particularly with the NSR program or the PSD program, there's a provision that says if you're a major source, you have to get an air permit limit for any pollutant regulated under the Clean Air Act. And so by regulating CO2 emissions from automobiles, it triggered a permit application so that anybody who that was a major source or would be a major source would be required to get an NSR permit or a PSD permit for CO2 or other greenhouse gas emissions. That was problematic because given the major source thresholds in the Clean Air Act, that literally meant that there would be hundreds of thousands of major sources and you couldn't build one. You couldn't build an office building. You couldn't build a school. Without getting a PSD permit, and that process is lengthy. So in order to deal with that issue, the Obama administration did something called the tailoring rule, where they basically said, this would be an overwhelming burden. You know, maybe someday we'll get around to regulating all major sources, but for now, we're only going to treat major sources as sources that emit more than 100,000 tons of CO2. So that would give you a sense of the scale here. 250 tons is of a conventional air pollutant is roughly, you know, equivalent to 100,000 tons of CO2 emissions. So it's sort of complicated. They recognize that by regulating CO2 emissions from automobiles, it would trigger these other requirements. And they tried to deal with that through something called the tailoring rule.
Yeah. And Jeff, can you tell us if there's any distinction to be made between EPA's endangerment finding when it comes to mobile sources versus stationary sources?
We refer to the endangerment, and I've referred to the endangerment finding as though it were just one thing. In fact, though, there are two slightly different places in which it comes up. Initially, it came up in the context of regulating vehicles under Section 201, and I've quoted that language multiple times. And, you know, the question is whether these vehicles can cause or contribute to air pollution that would reasonably be anticipated to endanger public welfare. When it comes to regulating industrial sources under Section 2 and under Section 111, the regulation is the statutory language is different in an important way because it says that EPA can regulate if it finds that these sources cause or significantly contribute to air pollution that is reasonably anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. And with regard to stationary sources, I think there is an argument that even if you look at emissions from the U.S. power sector, if you look at current emissions and projections about future emissions, their contribution is pretty small. And of course, you could say that about any industry or any country because it's really this collective emissions. But that actually seems like it's potentially more fruitful. But that would only deal with stationary sources. Power plants being the principal example, but there's certainly pressure to regulate cement plants and refineries and other things. And the argument would be, well, they don't significantly contribute to air pollution, which is reasonably anticipated to endanger. That doesn't help them with the mobile sources. And that seems to be sort of a primary focus of their efforts to reverse the endangerment finding, because they do often point to the costs imposed by the so-called EV mandate, and the president has certainly made it clear that he wants to eliminate that.
Well, that sort of gets us into anything else that might be triggered. Like, so we talked about when EPA made the endangerment finding with respect to GHGs, and you talked a little bit about the triggers that come once EPA makes an endangerment finding. What does it have to do?
Well, specifically making it under 201 meant that they had an obligation to regulate it from vehicles from so-called major sources. They then arguably have other obligations. The one thing that immediately comes to mind is you do have these permitting requirements. So that's automatically triggered without EPA taking any further action. But there was also pressure from the environmental community to regulate CO2 emissions from other industrial sources. And power plants was, you know, sort of the largest single source, at least back then it was. It's now second to vehicle emissions. But the power sector was sort of the obvious industrial sector that they would target. And they did that under what they called the Clean Power Plan, which is probably well known to those people who follow these issues. But it was the subject of a lot of controversy and litigation that ended up in the Supreme Court.
And it seems to me, like looking back on the past 15 or so years since the endangerment finding, rules that have focused on regulating carbon dioxide or regulating methane, regulating GHGs, they've been particularly difficult, particularly contentious, really heavily litigated. What do you think has contributed to that? Is that just, you know, commercial and industrial pushback on the rules, or is part of that problem with regulating in this space the fact that what you've already talked about, that the Clean Air Act wasn't designed and hasn't been amended to give EPA a clear path forward for acting on these.
So you won't be surprised to hear that it's actually really complicated, right? Because I will say that methane emissions, at least from oil and gas operations, are subject to the same kind of controls that oil and gas operations always have, because when EPA regulates volatile organic compounds, VOC emissions, what they do is to try to prevent leaks and other things. And so using those same tools, those same types of regulations, they could regulate methane emissions. Those have been controversial because they're viewed as being very costly and unreasonably burdensome. So that's a little more typical, as you know, that, you know, there are other regulations of other substances that raise similar concerns. Regulation of CO2 from the automobile sector has led to what some people call the EV mandate, or, you know, zero emission vehicles. And what that really points to, I think, is the biggest problem. And let's put all the other pollutants to aside, methane and hydrofluorocarbons and other things. If you're talking about CO2, fossil fuels really has been sort of the foundation of much of the economic growth that's occurred over the last 200 years. And people have been brought out of poverty. Many of the things that we take for granted, like electricity, like mobility, is a result of fossil fuels. And so I think the main reason that's been controversial, part of it has been the cost, but to reduce CO2 emissions, there aren't add-on technologies that you can, it's not like you can put on a scrubber or an SCR. For automobiles, it's meant transitioning away, or at least efforts by EPA and NHTSA to compel people to buy more EVs and other zero emission vehicles. In the power sector, it's been controversial because EPA actually made an effort to transition the power sector away from fossil fuels and more towards renewables. So anyway, this is a long and winding answer, but it's, you know, it turns out to be very complicated. And again, part of it is, if you look at the programs of the Clean Air Act, they were just not designed to deal with a substance like CO2, where, you know, wherever you burn fossil fuels, you're going to produce CO2. And, you know, there is an argument now that at least for some sources, they can use carbon capture and sequestration, which a few sources have started to adopt now. But other than CCS, the only way to reduce CO2 emissions is to use less fossil fuel.
And so, Jeff, that's really helpful to hear, because I think the contentious nature of this issue is, of course, has led us to discuss it today, because now we're, you know, faced with an administration that's considering rolling back this prior finding. What are your thoughts on the Trump administration strategies to now try to repeal something that has sort of served as the basis for so many different regulatory actions by the agency? I'm curious as to what your thoughts are about how they intend to do that and what thoughts they have expressed so far in press releases and other publications.
So I think there are certainly advocacy groups on the right who believe that the only way to prevent EPA from overregulating is to eliminate the endangerment finding. And if that were to be done and upheld in court, then that would eliminate EPA's authority to regulate CO2 and some other greenhouse gases. There's been, I think, a small but influential group of people who've been pushing that now for many years, including during the Trump administration. And they did, I know, push EPA and the administration to reverse the endangerment finding. But back then, there was a decision made, I think, by both Trump administrators, Scott Pruitt, and then later Andrew Wheeler, that was not a sort of a feasible option for reducing the regulatory burden, for reasons that I assume we'll discuss. I think a lot of us assumed that in the second Trump administration, they would reach a similar conclusion, that was probably not an effective way to undo these regulations. But they announced just what I guess in the last month, that they in fact are going to reconsider the endangerment finding. And I think there's been enough statements from administration officials that we have a pretty good idea of the rationale that they intend to use to revoke that finding.
So from their press releases and some of the other publications, Jeff, it sounds like cost is a big factor that they're considering, right? And I know that this was a one of the arguments that was made when the Obama administration undertook the initial endangerment finding, some industry groups argued that the endangerment finding had in fact not considered the costs that would result from regulating CO2 under the Clean Air Act. Do you think, given some of those past arguments were rejected by the DC Circuit, do you think they could have legs for the administration now? Or do you think costs will probably be a non-starter if they have to defend some sort of, you know, repeal of the endangerment finding on that basis before the DC Circuit?
So, you know, we don't know exactly what they will do and how they will make those arguments. But Taylor, as you noted, there is a rather lengthy press release that they released when they said they were going to reconsider it. And they criticized the Obama administration for not considering the downstream impacts. They use sort of that term, but it's clear that what they're thinking about is cost. And they emphasize that as a result of that finding, prior administrations have proposed rules for vehicles that would impose over $1 trillion worth of cost. And so that certainly suggests that they think cost is a relevant factor. As you pointed out, a similar argument was, well, when industry groups and red states challenged the endangerment finding, I don't think they explicitly said you should consider costs, but they did talk about the downstream impacts. And their basic argument was, look, at regulating CO2 would have enormous impacts on the economy. It's certainly going to implicate people's health and welfare just by making things more expensive, and that EPA needed to take all of those things into effect. The DC Circuit said, no, the statute's pretty clear that the endangerment finding is purely a scientific finding. And that was their reading of Massachusetts versus EPA and the DC Circuit panel that reviewed that. And similar courts have reached similar determinations. So we'll have to see how the Trump administration sort of deals with those prior cases. I'm sure that they will, if they do pursue this path, they'll have maybe a more sophisticated argument. Part of the problem, though, with the argument about cost is, unlike other programs under the Clean Air Act, making the endangerment finding doesn't really do anything to impact costs, because the various regulations that EPA promulgates are regulations in which the agency is specifically required to take costs into account, whether you're talking about vehicles, whether you're talking about industrial sources. And so at the time the endangerment finding is made, it's impossible for anyone to know what the costs will be. And it is true that the Obama and Biden administrations imposed very costly regulations, but the Trump administration has undone many of those and has said it's going to do others. So are you considering the cost that the most aggressive Democratic administration might impose? Or are you considering the much more modest cost that presumably a Republican administration would impose? So it's very difficult to know how EPA should take costs into account in making the endangerment finding, because, you know, all that does is sort of authorize EPA to regulate. It doesn't say anything about how stringently they need to regulate.
And that makes me think that if the Trump administration were to say, and revising or reconsidering the endangerment finding, if at that stage with respect solely to the endangerment question, if costs were considered, I think you might have a Loper Bright problem, because the statute doesn't say when the administrator is to make those determinations that he should consider costs. It's those subsequent actions that are based on the endangerment finding where you can start to fold in some of those considerations.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I've sort of gone through the mental exercise of saying, well, gee, you know, if EPA still were to get Chevron deference, could they interpret that language somehow as being broad enough to look at, you know, the overall impact on society and the impact of potentially forcing people away from, you know, reliable, affordable electricity? But it's really hard, I think, to, given the language of the statute, it certainly appears to be purely a scientific decision. You know, the question is whether it will cause or contribute to air pollution, which is reasonably anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. You know, it seems to be about the effect of the pollutant, not the effect of regulating the pollutant. And as you know, one of the other issues that the Supreme Court stressed is they do look to agencies' longstanding and contemporaneous interpretation of the statute, sort of going back to when it was originally adopted. And I think, you know, that language was meant to suggest that if agencies are going to be, you know, taking new interpretations, especially expansive interpretations, that they would be suspect. But, you know, now we have 50 years of EPA interpreting the endangerment finding as being purely a scientific question. And I should point out that that same basic language occurs in under three different Clean Air Act programs. And all of them, it has been viewed and really hasn't been challenged as being exclusively a scientific determination, as opposed to one that considered all these other factors.
And do you think there's any path for this administration to get to the major questions aspect of EPA regulating carbon dioxide with West Virginia versus EPA and the idea that Congress needs to speak clearly when there are particularly significant questions that have a potential for a huge effect on the economy? Is there a path for this administration to put that argument to the Supreme Court and say, Congress really hasn't clearly spoken to this issue? And what would that do to Massachusetts versus EPA if they did?
So there's been no public indications that that's the strategy, but I think that that must be in the back of their minds, in part because I believe that if that question, if Massachusetts versus EPA were to make its way again to the Supreme Court, I think under the major questions doctrine, they would say pretty clearly, there's no indication that Congress clearly intended for EPA to regulate CO2 emissions. And so under the major questions doctrine, CO2 is not an air pollutant within the meaning of the Clean Air Act. So I do think that, you know, if Massachusetts versus EPA were to be litigated for the first time now in the Supreme Court, I think EPA would be told it doesn't have authority. Certainly, they can argue that in the D.C. Circuit, but very well could be that they're hoping that even if they lose on the endangerment finding, they go back to the Supreme Court and perhaps they could get the Supreme Court to revisit that question. And of course, we don't know how the court would react. We've seen on some major issues, the Supreme Court has been willing to overturn prior decisions, but those have all been in cases involving constitutional issues. And in questions of statutory interpretations, the court rarely, if ever, overturns a prior statutory interpretation. And what they've said is, you know, if we interpret a statute incorrectly, then it's up to Congress to correct us. So this is a big enough issue that perhaps that is their strategy, and perhaps that would be successful, that this court would say, given what we now know about the regulation and given the major questions doctrine, that reviewing it under that standard, we would find that EPA doesn't have authority to regulate. And one thing about that approach is that would effectively prevent future EPAs from regulating CO2 emissions. Whereas under the endangerment finding, even if they could do that, and even if that were to be upheld in court, it certainly seems like the next Democratic administration could come along and, you know, review the same evidence or new evidence and reach a different conclusion. So I think that very well may be their thinking, that maybe this is a way to get the court to revisit Massachusetts versus EPA.
It seems like that approach would take it off the table permanently. Whereas if they just were to look at costs or find some other basis to reach a finding that there was no endangerment, you could imagine the next administration coming along and we would see the endangerment finding sort of jump in the same category with Waters of the United States or the National Environmental Policy Act or some of the Endangered Species Act regulations, where you have these, you could almost set your watch to them now, but the sort of back and forth between presidential administrations of succeeding parties. Jeff, what would EPA do with regulations that are on the books? Taylor talked about these briefly, that have been predicated on the endangerment finding, right? EPA issues the endangerment finding in 2009, and they've taken several actions based on that finding. If you knock out the endangerment finding, do those regulations topple? What happens to them?
So that's something that I think a lot of us in this business have thought about. And I believe that reversing the endangerment finding would not automatically revoke all those regulations, that EPA would have to go through a separate process to propose and then finalize rules but they could rely entirely on the endangerment findings. So from a procedural perspective, they would have to do more. But from a substantive perspective, they wouldn't. They can just say, we no longer have authority to regulate this, so we're revoking the vehicle standards or the Section 111 rules for power plants, or even the methane rules for oil and gas operations. Although I think that's a little more complicated. That makes a lot of people, including me, a little nervous, because that would mean that if the DC Circuit rejects their reversal of the endangerment finding, those other regulations would spring back into place. And so, and I don't want to talk about the vehicle regulations too much. I don't work on those, but with respect to the power plant rules, you know, I think the Biden administration rules are well beyond what can be justified under the statute, because they would require carbon capture and sequestration on essentially all new gas-fired plants, you know, based on a determination that technology has been adequately demonstrated, when in fact there's not a gas-fired power plant anywhere in the world that has CCS. And we don't have thousands of miles of CO2 pipelines and things like that. So I think there's a very strong legal basis for revoking the Biden clean power, the wire power plant rules. But if they rely exclusively on reversing the endangerment finding, then they haven't sort of made those arguments that I think are much more likely to be upheld in court.
One of the things that we've not talked about on this podcast before, Taylor, is the plethora of state and federal climate suits that are sort of predicated on tort theories. And I'm curious, Jeff, you know, we've talked a little bit about this, but that Supreme Court case from, I think, 2011, AEP versus Connecticut, which found that because EPA has the authority under the Clean Air Act in Massachusetts versus EPA to regulate carbon dioxide, you know, that case concluded that any sort of federal common law claims based on nuisance or other tort theories related to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions were effectively preempted, right? EPA was going to regulate in this space, and whether it regulated or not, Congress gave EPA that authority. And we hear about children's climate suits and all these other sort of state superfund or climate superfund programs. What happens to that federal field preemption if Massachusetts versus EPA falls away? Are we just going to see more of these suits? Will they become actionable?
Well, you know, it's hard to believe we could have more of these suits because, as you know, there are probably hundreds of suits. But in most of those cases, and I can't pretend to be aware of all of them, but certainly the ones that I know about, the leading defense is the AEP versus Connecticut case, where they point out that the Supreme Court has already said that because Congress provided this authority to EPA, that these other types of actions were preempted. And we see that not only in the nuisance cases and the tort cases under state common law, but also in challenging the climate superfund. I think that if the Supreme Court were to reverse Massachusetts versus EPA, then that would eliminate the preemption argument and would be backed. I mean, there's lots of other defenses, right? But sort of the simple, cleanest one, the one that has been sort of the leading defense, would no longer be in place. There's been some argument over whether reversing the endangerment finding would eliminate that. The argument is, well, they ask, you know, EPA did have authority if it made an endangerment. And if, since they say there's no endangerment, you know, that effectively means that the federal government has said that, you know, we shouldn't be regulating these things, even though they could be regulated. I think reversing the endangerment finding probably weakens the preemption defense. Whether it eliminates it, I think we just don't know.
And it's fascinating because it seems like whatever choice this administration makes with respect to endangerment, you know, if they take a sort of a cost-based approach to repealing the endangerment finding, well, maybe you have an argument that the AEP versus Connecticut field preemption is still in effect. It's still a pollutant and EPA regulates it. It's just chosen, or EPA believes that it's not endangering public health or welfare, right? So maybe you still have that. But then if you have that sort of major questions doctrine approach, that more permanent approach where you maybe force a revisitation of Massachusetts versus EPA and finding that, hey, Congress doesn't have any authority to regulate something like carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions. Well, we're back in that.
Right. EPA doesn't have authority.
Yeah.
Congress certainly has authority.
That's true. That's true. Interstate Commerce Clause. If you take that approach and you conclude that EPA lacks authority to regulate something like carbon dioxide, well, then, man, that, it seems like that opens the floodgates of litigation. So both strategies seems like they have some interesting drawbacks or interesting costs of their own.
You know, I think I can say, because this is already public, that there certainly have been industry groups who have been lobbying against reversing the endangerment finding. I'm aware of businesses and trade associations that have lobbied EPA and said, you know, it would be a bad thing for you to reverse the endangerment finding, in part because of the fact that it would certainly weaken if it wouldn't eliminate the preemption defense. So that's one of the other interesting things about this is, you know, the business community, at least the vast majority of I think the entities involved are not pushing for a reversal of the endangerment finding. And I mean, they certainly would like to see some EPA rules be made more reasonable, but the endangerment finding is a case where the Trump administration seems to, and that's certainly their prerogative, they don't need to listen to the business groups, but they seem to have kind of a different view.
So, you know, Daniel mentioned earlier that should the Trump administration succeed in repealing the endangerment finding, we could get into a world in which the endangerment finding becomes one of the other issues that sort of flip-flops back and forth between administrations. Is there a world in which you see them able to repeal or pull back this finding in a way that's durable so that it doesn't become one of these, you know, flip-flopping issues, sort of like Waters of the United States or NEPA? Or do you think, you know, if they do take action to roll it back, do you think it's sort of inevitable that the endangerment finding will become something that each administration kind of tries their way at and flip-flops back and forth in terms of what they think the EPA can regulate?
So I know that there are people on, and I'll say on the right, who believe that if EPA does just a good enough job of dealing with the science, that they could make such a strong case that would prevent a future EPA from just reversing and going back and reinstating the endangerment finding. I guess I'm skeptical of that. You know, new science is emerging and all the time on these issues, and it just seems to me that we are likely to get another Democratic administration relatively soon. And again, maybe that's wrong. But I think the next time there is a Democratic administration, that it would be relatively simple for them to reinstate the endangerment finding. It, you know, this gets to be messy for everyone, and especially automobile companies that have to plan out their production years in advance, and industrial sources where they're making billions of dollars worth of investment, and they like to have some certainty about the future. So I still remain optimistic that maybe there could actually be some sort of climate change legislation that would provide a more stable investment in climate for companies. I think, you know, it would never be what environmentalist groups say is necessary, but there could be something that I think the business community could live with. But I don't foresee that kind of legislation, certainly in this Congress, and probably not under this president. But a long way of answering your question, I do think there's a significant chance of sort of flip-flopping back and forth. And of course, Loper Bright was supposed to eliminate that kind of flip-flopping, but that's only with regard to statutory construction. Once the statute is interpreted as the best interpretation, then that's supposed to stick. Without Chevron deference, you can't go back and forth. But on these sort of scientific issues, I don't think there's any way to sort of prevent that from happening when a new administration comes along and has additional science that they can rely on, and maybe even different interpretations of existing science.
Nice. Daniel, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I always just, wouldn't it be so nice to have a nice piece of legislation
that makes things clear?
That makes things clear and predictable. Well, Jeff, you've given us a lot to think about and chew on, but I do feel more prepared after this conversation of tracking what we're going to see from this administration. I know that we're all looking closely to see what EPA does here. I think it's going to be a really fascinating study, and we'll have to see if down the road Congress takes action to address greenhouse gases in the statutory text of the Clean Air Act. But until then, we'll always enjoy turning to you for some guidance on what's going on at EPA and how the actions EPA takes today may shape litigation and what companies come to expect over the coming year. So thank you again for joining us. And thank you, listeners, as always, for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you soon.